fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
What's up? I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a slew of books that are coming out this week. We have so many books, we're going to jump right into it. Kicking it off.
It's a really nice number of books. It's not too many. You know what I mean?
Oh, you're feeling good about it.
All right, I'm feeling good about the number. You know what I mean?
Okay. All right. Yeah. I do always worry about that. You're always in my head, Pete.
Well, yeah. When you get over 30 books, I'm like, what are we doing? You know what I mean? We need to break this up into separate amounts of shows because then we're just talking too long at one clip where I feel like, you know, you don't want someone who's loves comics and excited about comics running out of gas. You know what I mean?
Right. You wouldn't want somebody tuning into a show hoping to get into some comic book reviews and suddenly two guys are talking about the process behind their show or something like that. Right?
Oh my God. Yeah, that would be the worst, Alex. Thanks for bringing that up.
No problem. Absolute Power, Super Son, number one from DC Comics, written by Sita Grace and Nicole Maines, art by John Timms and Travis Mercer. This is spinning off of the Absolute Power event. John Kent was taken over by the Brainiac Queen. He was freed from her influence in Absolute Power number 3. And here we're dealing with the fallout of that as he is on Themyscira. I always mispronounce that. I'm sorry.
Themyscira.
Themyscira, isn't it?
I thought it was Themyscira.
Wonder Woman's Island.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah, anyway, he is there and they are trying to see if he has in fact been purged of the Brainiac Queen's influence. And in the process, we go through a journey into his mind, toured around by what is supposed to be a mind version of Dreamer from his memory. We get to see various scenes with his friends and family in different respects. Pete, I kind of know what you're going to say about this, so I'm just going to go first here.
You know what I'm going to say.
Well, you haven't liked this Absolute Power event, so I feel like you're going to be kind of negative about it.
Oh, weird. Well, why not you let me actually go?
And go ahead. This surprise is cool. Surprise me.
This is cool. Oh. I'm really enjoying the Jay and John stuff. I'm not sure what is real or not.
But, and is this reference to the comic book or your life or what are we talking about here?
Well, there's stuff that's like in a dream and then there's stuff that's actually happening. You know what I
right.
mean?
So when you're asleep, that's murky. The stuff in the dream. When you're
talking about the comic book, you fucking.
Thank you for specifying. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm talking about this comic. There's a little bit of a murkiness of what's really happening. But yeah, I enjoyed this issue. I'm a sucker for, you know, relationships, so some good stuff in here.
I thought this was great. I really like this a lot. I was definitely looking forward to this because I thought the team would do a good job of plumbing into the trauma of this event, and that's exactly what they did. You know, I thought what was really impressive about this is using superhero tropes, which is a evil alien robot infecting a young Superman's mind, and using it as a metaphor for how trauma doesn't go away, you know, that you can kind of get better, but it's always going to be there in the back of your mind. That came out very effectively through the book. I agree with you on the relationship stuff. They also didn't back away from the hard thing of John feels like he's a different person. Jay is dealing with some stuff that I won't spoil here on his own that comes out at the end of the issue. And they end up in a very different place, but it also isn't dealing in absolutes. It's dealing with the rough parts of a relationship about two people who care about each other but are going through a really tough time. And that they took a break in the middle of an event to hit this, I thought was all the more awesome. I will also throw out there, loved seeing Dreamer again. I thought that was great. I do want to get into spoilery things because I wanted to see if you feel the same about this. So we are told in this issue that what we are experiencing is a memory John has of Dreamer. But there's at least one scene where Dreamer is off by herself while John leaves. And that to me indicates, I think this is Dreamer. She may not realize it's Dreamer, but there is something left there. She didn't die in absolute power. There's also a moment that felt like maybe one-sided, but maybe there were some romantic feelings that Dreamer had towards John, which I was very surprised about. So I think there's more to come with Dreamer, and I think that's indicated by this issue. What do you think, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, there could be more to come. I didn't really dissect it like that, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of the love triangle.
To be clear, like, it felt like Dreamer was like, do I have feelings towards John? And I don't think the way that they drew it, that John was picking up on it necessarily.
Typical male, not picking up on, just fucking around. All right.
Yeah. Anyway, great issue. Definitely pick this up. Moving on from a middle
fantastic
to an end.
Fantastic art. Just to be clear.
Oh, yeah. Great. Darth Vader, number 5 from
Darth
Marvel.
Darth Vader.
We're already off to a very good start here. Written by Greg Pak, art by Raphael Anko, Paul Frey, Luke Ross, and Adam Gorham. This is the final issue of the Darth Vader title after 50 issues as Star Wars is moving eras in Marvel Comics versus Charles Soule's book, which was a lot more of a kind of like standalone one shot and wrapping up some threads. Mm-hmm. This is very much finishing Greg Pak's run here. This is picking up after the last issue, but it is oversized, ties up a bunch of stuff. Anyway, Pete, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it says right on the cover, it's the series finale. But yeah, I mean, I was hoping we get into a Pak stock, where we could talk about a couple of the Pak books that came out. But, I'm not the guy who organizes it. But I really think that this is...
There's a whole week where you could talk to me about that offline.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, there
it
is.
Seems like this is the perfect time. I very much enjoyed this. It's too bad we've never had Greg Pak on our show to talk about something like this.
Oh, we did. But... You ditched that time.
Oh,
you ding dong ditched
you.
The show.
How dare you, sir? I wish I could have been there. I thought this was super enjoyable. I also love the Charles Soule stuff, that's the nice thing about comics. We have different people kind of doing different things.
Yeah, I'm not pitting them against each other. What is better? You figure out which it is.
Yeah, I'm Team Pak.
I'm not saying I like both of them. They're different approaches to a final issue like this. That was my point.
Well, it wasn't clear. Okay, so now that we've clarified that, I very much enjoyed this. And, reading this, I was like, I don't know why someone would think they could fuck with Vader. But, man, that was just dumb. This is awesome and sad, but awesome. Powerful ending, very cool. Yeah, just really amazing art. I just think it's, like, interesting because I know what's going to happen. You know what I mean? Like these comics
really
take place that, I've seen Star Wars a bunch.
Okay. Don't spoil it for me.
But what's
I'm doing this in order. I've only watched up to Empire Strikes Back, then read all of these comics, and then fingers crossed, I'm hoping to watch Return of the Jedi someday.
Yeah, enjoy it. I just think that
as long as there's no fucking little Wookiee characters, I'm going to.
Oh, my God. I got some bad news for you. And I don't appreciate that because I love Return of the Jedi. OK, mm-hmm. Anyways, what I'm trying to say here is that I've seen this a ton, yet the writing and the storytelling is still good. I'm still reading it being like, come on, Vader, do the right thing, you piece of shit. Just, and it's that's how good it is that mm-hmm. even though you know what's going to happen, you still kind of get wrapped up in the moment.
And similarly, I continue to be impressed how the Star Wars Marvel writers get so much mileage out of flashing to scenes from the past, just playing off scenes of Anakin with scenes of Vader very emotionally affecting. So it's good stuff. Great issue. Definitely check it out. Next up, Destro, number 4, from Death Star to Destro, from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Dan Waters, art by Andre Bresson. Destro was left for dead last issue. Turns out he's not. And
what a twist.
I know.
Comics, man. Oh, man. I tell
you what. There is a little bit of a twist by the end here as somebody new teams up with Tomax and Zamot. Is that what it is?
Tomax and Zamot.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I don't speak your native language of all-American hero.
We're not very good at English. We've clearly shown that.
Yes.
But yeah,
go ahead, Pete.
Oh, thank you.
This is your thing.
Yeah. When this issue ended, I was like, oh shit, it's a party now. This, finally things are coming together. Like, they've been teased. So very exciting last page reveal that I've been waiting for. Awesome art, fun story. This kicks ass. It's just like, I also think that they had a really nice lesson here for the kids that even if you're a supervillain, you got to take time and read. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There can be a lot of things going on in your life, but sometimes you just need a time out and just read. You know what I mean? Just do some reading. It can really recharge you, give you some focus on life. So even Destro is coming with the lessons, which I think is kind of fun because G.I. Joe, you know, would kind of give you a little PSA at the end of it. So that's nice to see they're revisiting that in this issue.
And now you know.
The more you know. Yeah.
Now you know this, G.I. Joe. I really appreciate this is the funniest Energon Universe series. Like, it's very darkly satirical, but getting into the war industrial complex, smartly done, very fun, good title.
Yeah.
Helen of Windtorn, number 4 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Todd King, art by Bilquis Evely. This is taking place in a couple of different timelines, but the main timeline is following the title character as she tries to build herself up to be a warrior who is worthy of her grandfather. Really incredible issue here. I've liked this series so far, but I loved this one. I thought it was very powerfully done. It's dark. It's upsetting, some of the things that happen here. But well-drawn characters, and I mean that both from the writing and the art perspective.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, one of the reasons, and you were making fun of me of this before, that the reason this I didn't mention it on my favorite picks from the stack is this gets sad, man. And it's it hurts you a little bit because of what Helen's going through here and, looking for approval from other people. And it's, I don't want to spoil anything, but man, amazing art, just absolutely gorgeous, pulls you into this absolutely fantastical world, so enjoyable, but it's going to get you in the feels.
Now, I don't want to do another point of order business thing that we could probably take offline. We've only been doing the show for like 16 or 17 years here, but what we do on the live show is we talk about what we're looking forward to. Like what's coming out tomorrow, what we're interested to check out because it hasn't
come
out.
And I didn't mention this.
No, I know, but it's not my favorite books that I've read. It's what I'm looking forward to. So going into the week where you're looking at the list. No, it's not semantics because you talk about what you're excited about and then we find out whether that panned out on the stack. That's the way we've done it for 17 years, but I guess however you want to do it is fine. Anyway, Dazzler number 1 from Marvel, written by Jason Liu, art by Rafael Leroux. I'm having a great time.
Glad one person is.
Dazzler is going to ruin the tour. What tour? The world tour. But as she travels around, she sings some songs and deals with anti-mutant prejudice in this issue. Pete, you love anti-mutant prejudice. What'd you think about this?
How dare you, sir? How dare you? Sorry, I was just texting Justin to help me. I don't enjoy Dazzler.
That's like, please, I'm so thirsty. I've been in this desert so long. And instead of calling water, you text poison to come get you?
Anyways, I was trying to just mention that Dazzler is a character not very much in my wheelhouse of fun. So I wasn't exactly pumped to read this, But, you know, once that creepy manager made the shark girl change who she was, I just started yelling boo at my comic. So
because you don't like prejudice, but if you were yelling boo, you were into it, right? Like it was making you feel something.
Sure, I guess. Not the things that I want to feel. You know what I mean?
Right. But then it led to a powerful moment at the end where Shark Girl stood up for herself and Dazzler stood up for her. I thought that was great.
You know, also people could just be good. You know what I mean? So could just enjoy.
I'm sorry. So your note for this issue of Dazzler is what if everybody was nice? What if instead there was no conflict?
I'm not a writer. I'm not trying to tell people how to write. I'm just talking about things that I enjoy. See, Alex, we've been doing this for 17 years, and let me explain something to you.
By the way, I just want to mention in that desert metaphor earlier, I'm a cactus. So there is water inside of me, but you got to get through some spines.
I would murder you in a second if you could give us water to keep. Talk about how much you love Dazzler. Why don't you go ahead? You're secretly a teenage girl, so why don't you go ahead?
I like this book. I thought the art was good. I thought the plot was very focused on the concert, which is fine. The songs were fine. But I actually thought the Shark Girl part was the best part of the book. Seeing that emotional arc there of her being told to hide herself, ultimately coming out as a mutant accidentally on stage. I thought that was very well done, but there was a lot of other things going on around it. That's my take. So, all right issue with a good emotional hook in the middle. Multiverses Collision Detected, number one from DC Comics, written by Brian Q. Miller, art by John Samariva. Yep, I got it right the first time. I didn't need to correct myself. Anyway, this is based on the game Multiverses that we all know and love. That's basically Super Smash Brothers, except with the Warner Brothers characters. And in this issue, the DC Universe is being invaded by other Warner Brothers properties. You say, of course, Pete, as if you actually mean, of course. Have you been playing this game?
Nope. But I knew it existed.
Oh, okay. There we go. Yeah, I don't think it's made too much of an impact on the culture is the slight problem here. But how do you feel this exists as a comic book?
Well, I thought this was, first off, some real sick covers. If we could back up the truck for a moment. And I love the start. You know, I felt like the fun banter the kids have while they're playing video games. I thought that really was such a fun slice of life of just kind of like talking things out. And the one person's like, whatever, I don't want a story. I just want to see them fight. I felt very seen there, which was really nice. I also love the art. It's got a great vibe to it. Seems welcoming and fun. Yeah, I thought this was super cute and very interesting and kind of a cool way to approach it all. And I mean, anytime you get to see Bugs Bunny, I mean, it's a classic Bugs entrance right there. So, you know, yeah, it's been a while since I've got to hang out with Bugs. So I'm looking forward to it.
I was okay with this. I think I would have loved to see the collision happen a little sooner, particularly because we know that's the concept of the book. I did like the thing that you pointed out. Them pointedly being like, hey, we're going to tell you the story here. This isn't all about fighting. But I don't think it got enough into the emotional story. It was just basically a mystery of what's going on here with Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. So I'm interested to check out the second issue to see if it gets into a little bit more of that. You know, this is tough, but I feel like the high standard for me of video game books is the, I'm forgetting exactly what it was called, but like the Batman Fortnite thing that focused on Bat and Cat.
Oh my God, that was so fun.
That was phenomenal. And the thing that made it work almost more than anything was hooking it on the emotional relationship between Batman and Catwoman. I think that's what something like this needs and what it's missing right now. It's mostly going for a fun, funny book for kids, and that's okay. But
yeah, there's nothing wrong with that, man.
There is something wrong with that. Let's talk about, it's not, I'm kidding. Let's talk about what are your favorite books of the week, or at least one of the ones that you were looking forward to the most.
Yeah, that's how I worded it
last night. The Tin Can Society, number one from Image Comics, written by Peter Warren, art by Francesco Bobbi. This focuses on a bunch of kids who were of the Tin Can Society of the title when they're all grown up. There's a bit of a murder mystery they need to deal with involving one of their own. I would liken it to like Watchmen meets The Big Chill is kind of the pitch here. Oh, it doesn't exactly go in those directions, but that's what's close to it. But Pete, you seem to be totally enamored of this comic book. Why?
Well, first off, it's a hell of a first issue. I mean, a lot of interesting shit going down here. You know, we have some kids in a group that, you know, it's a ragtag team, which I love. A bunch of, you know, not the cool kids, if you will. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I love the art, love the story. I felt like they did such a good job of setting up this friend group. And then they kind of like, all right, we got to figure out who did what to whom and why. So I feel like as a first issue, they really killed it of like giving us this world and then wanting us to know more.
I like this as well. Just because of the comparisons to Watchmen in particular, a lot of the characters sort of went one-to-one with some of the Watchmen characters. You don't exactly have a Dr. Manhattan there, but certainly
there's
seems
no
like,
Blue Dong in this.
There's no, just wait for issue two. It's going to be all Blue Dog all the way down. But you have a lot of characters that seem a little similar to that. I do think the Big Chill, they knew each other, were friends back in the day, and now they're older. Gives it a different riff. It's clearly a different world as well. But I do think the characters, regardless of that, are very well delineated and interesting. Yeah. There's an interesting mystery that's set up here. So I'm very intrigued to check out the second issue. And Francesca Mabue's art is great, jumping from the kid scenes to the adult scenes, superhero stuff to just scenes of taking photographs. I thought that was all very well done. So if you're looking for a new pseudo-realistic superhero mystery series, this is one to check out.
Great.
Paranoid Gardens, number 3 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Gerard Way and Sean Simon, art by Chris Weston. This takes place in
haunting art. Haunting.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And this takes place in a facility, a care facility that is slowly being attacked by outside forces. There are monsters in there. There are superheroes. There's regular people. We're following a person named Lou who is somehow connected to it in a way that we don't understand yet. I thought this was the best issue of the series so far, and I can get into why, but it gets into spoilers. But Pete, I'm curious to hear what you think.
This is an insane comic, and I don't understand all that's happening, but I also think I'm not supposed to yet. But I'm having a great time reading it. Amazing art, intense story, a lot of kind of moving pieces, but man, it's very enjoyable. The monster faces on the people who work at the kind of facility, so creepy. They really stay with you. It's really impressive, the art styling in this.
Yeah. So this potential spoilers, and I say potential because they don't spell out anything in this book, but let me throw this out to you.
Buddy.
Here's what I think is going on based on this issue, and I don't have it all figured out because I don't know what's going on with Lou, the main character, necessarily. But you've got these villains who are trying to get into Paranoid Gardens who are dressed in these monkey masks with dollar bill chains around their necks, right? I think they're I think they're NFTs. I think they're bored apes. They look a lot like them. There's a scene in here where somebody is praying to an altar of paraphernalia. I think the idea here is it's a fight between art and commerce. And art is Paranoid Gardens. It can be anything, right? You've got monsters. You've got superheroes. You've got normal people. Well, as soon as they bury some of these money monkeys in the ground, it starts to infect the art of the place with its commerce, with its homogeneity, or whatever it is. Just like the sameness of the outside world, of what commerce does to art by buying it and purchasing it and trying to quantify it in some way. We also get that with a guy trying to deliver packages when he shows up.
Well, that's where
company.
I think that because somebody bought something online and now that art is, you know, and I think that was where it all started to fall apart. But yeah,
Yeah, I think it's the last bastion of creativity is what they're doing. That's what this place is. That's what they're holding on to. And these outside forces, they're trying to bring it in there and quantify it and commodify it in some way. So I don't know. We'll see. But I was really intrigued and interested by this issue.
Yeah.
Spirits of Vengeance, number one from Marvel, written by Sabir Prasada, art by Sean Damian Hill. Here we're following a bunch of different Ghost Riders, including Vengeance, a Ghost Rider I am not personally familiar with, who lives in a cornfield and sits in a wheelchair. Pete?
Yeah, so first off, sick cover, bruh. I mean, this is just some crazy shit. Also, it gets real crazy because there's just kind of a skull scare. So a skull crow, I guess it is, if it's a scarecrow, yeah, but with a skull. So it's a skull crow, and some girl starts making out with it, and it's pretty gross. It's pretty gross. I there's dares, and then there's like, hey, make out with that skull. Oh, anyways.
What if it was like a really sexy skull, Pete? Would you make out with it?
I don't know what that means.
Like, okay, just close your eyes if you have to. But
no,
like,
I don't want to do that. No, I don't want to do
picture that. Like a real sexy skull.
No, there's no,
like,
my worry is it's not
sort of
clean.
Skull, the sort of skull you
it's
see.
It's not clean. Like, you're kissing something that's like rotting in the sun, and I mean, it's not sanitary in a lot of ways, and that's what freaked me out. Also, like,
bring a handy wipe, man.
There's this thing where the Spirit of Vengeance is in a wheelchair, and I was like, oh, this seems like a kind of opportunity lost, because I would love if we had a Ghost Rider in a wheelchair. That would be awesome. But it's kind of like this weird thing of like, it's, you know, not
inappropriate.
That, yeah, it's inappropriate, but I feel like if we did it right, it could be really cool. But anyways, I just felt like, yeah, I don't know. Anyways, it got weird.
I hear you. Definitely it makes me feel a little weird to think about versus thinking about a sexy skull, which makes me feel very good.
I don't know what your deal is. You're a weird perv. Anyways, I do think that, like,
I think you figured out what my deal was. You followed up saying, I don't know what your deal is, with explaining it.
Yeah, anyways, this also gets really weird where it's like, okay, now there's flames in a wheelchair, and then there's dinosaurs are real. I was like, there's a lot of different things going on.
There was a lot going on here, and it felt like every couple of pages there was a note like, you guys remember this issue of Ghost Rider from 45 years ago? And I was like, I certainly do not.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, I've read, I don't know if all the Ghost Rider, but a lot of it. And even I was like, I do
not.
Well,
to the point that one of the characters, one of the Ghost Riders, is fighting these sirens. And they're like, we're finally getting vengeance on you, Johnny Blaze or Danny Ketch. I'm not sure which one it is. And he's like, honestly, I don't remember who you guys are. And I was like, don't use them then. This is too much.
Yeah, that was
like,
a weird
I didn't
random
mind this book, but it's just, it's too much plot and it's too much to hold on to.
But I do hope that if they get kind of through whatever they're trying to get through, that hopefully this smooths out and becomes a better story.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Jenny Sparks, number two from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Jeff Spokes. So
how you want to unpack this, buddy? This is why I'm here today for this right here.
Oh, for this? This is why you're here today?
Yeah, this is why I got up in the morning, because I was like, I want to hear Alex explain this and talk about it.
Okay, so here's the story. Jenny Sparks is the spirit of the 20th century. She's now in the 21st century. Captain Atom wants to become a god, so he's taken a bunch of folks hostage in a bar. And she needs to get him out and get them all out safely somehow. A bunch of other things are going on here, including we find out that Superman and Jenny Sparks made out years ago and hooked up. That's pretty weird. And also we're cross-cut with what woke up Jenny Sparks after she died at the end of the 20th century, which was a little event. I don't know if you're familiar. Oh. We just celebrated the anniversary called 9/11. And in fact, the first page of this book, which I really wish there had been some sort of trigger warning about, is the burning Twin Towers.
Yeah. Oh, man. Like, we got to do something for 9/11. Maybe we should. Yeah, let's not. There's too much happening here. We got 9/11, and then she's smoking, which crossing 9/11 and someone who's smoking, I didn't know it would trigger me, but I was like, stop smoking. I'm trying to get the smoky towers out of my head, and then you're just chain smoking, and I'm just like, I don't like this. Also, the 2000 fashion trends, I can't. There's too much happening at once, and it doesn't fit together.
And, well, and I should mention, for context, everybody, Pete used to host Red Carpets with Joan Rivers, so you're very upset to see those looks coming back.
Rest in peace, Joan. I mean, yeah, oh, man. Yeah.
She's a legend. I also don't exactly know what to make about this. I think to get repetitive in terms of what I say about a lot of Tom King books, what he's getting at, I don't think is always readily apparent until you get to the last issue of the title. Mm-hmm. So tough to parse it here. We had talked about, I think it was on the live show, but we had talked about this issue when it came out, when the solicit came out, that 9/11 was the thing that woke up Jenny Sparks. My feeling about 9/11 in comic books is don't do it. And the reason I don't think you should do it is not just for the trigger warning nature of it, but just that 9/11 doesn't make sense in a superhero world for a lot of different.
You've said
that before. Yeah, I have said that before, but I'm saying it here in case people are listening for the first time or anything, because I was certainly reminded here, like, this is obviously going for a very serious, very ground level take on Jenny Sparks in a superhero world. It's a Black Label book, so it's out of continuity, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem with setting 9/11 in the DC and Marvel universe in particular is, and I don't say this lightly, but 9/11 happens once a week in those universes. Like, a comparable event happens. Coast City is destroyed. Venom symbiotes are attacking New York and taking over people and turning them into zombies. This stuff happens constantly in ridiculous, outrageous ways, which are obviously very different from how 9/11 was in our real world. But on the base level of how to parse, be like, what is different about this event than anything else? It becomes this sticky thorn bush of trying to parse, like, okay, here, let me explain to you why superheroes are reacting differently to 9/11 happening in the New York of the DC universe than the dark crisis that wiped out everybody last week. That's just not a ethical and moral quandary, let alone a plot thing that you want to get into. Not even the idea of, like, why didn't they stop it? You know, like, why didn't they stop 9/11 as superheroes? And that's also a thing you don't want to get into because real people died in the real world. So my take on it is leave it out. Do not reference it at all. And I understand that is what Tom King is trying to do here in terms of what is the division between the 20th century and the 21st century. This is when we lost that part of our innocence and our control and our freedom and all of these other things. I get that. But it makes it a harder read when you're already doing something that is taking, and I think it was just me and Justin on the show when we were talking about this, but the main thrust here seems to be taking Captain Atom back to the place that Alan Moore wanted to put him by making him the character who would eventually become Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen. That's what he's doing here. That's the riff that he's doing here. It's much more about Captain Atom in that way than it is about Jenny Sparks. But what it is saying about her and her Britishness and about the 20th century versus the 21st century, I do not know yet.
Yeah. I mean,
art's very good.
Art is amazing.
Tom King is a smart writer who I'm always intrigued to see what he has to say. This was a tough issue to read.
And hopefully by the end of it, we'll be won over by it.
Yeah. And honestly, if Tom King is listening, I think, like, think about, is there a title, What If Everything Was Nice? You know, like, wouldn't that be good? I don't know. Just thinking about it. spitballing there. Ice Cream Man, number 41, talking about titles where everything is nice, from Image Comics, written by W. Maxwell Prince, art by Martin Morazzo. In this issue, we're getting a James Bond riff as regular guy deals with some weird stuff in Cuba. I gotta say, I love every issue of this title. This was the least emotionally harrowing issue that they've done in, I don't know, I'm just looking at the numbers here, I want to say 41 issues, maybe?
Well, that's
which was surprising.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like, you know, we get a conspiracy kind of James Bond monster verse a little bit. And I kind of wrote right here, I was like, for 40 issues, it was, I was surprised, delighted, scared, creeped out, and this was the first time, and that's a hell of a, you know, to have 40 issues of a comic book and constantly be reinventing, constantly surprising with creative ideas and original stuff. And like, I'm not saying that this isn't that, I'm just saying that like, this was the first one where I was like, I wasn't blown away. I was like, oh, okay, this is fun. I mean, it's kind of a weird, you know, twist on James Bond. But yeah, 40 issues of just kind of like jaw dropping, holy shit, mind melting stuff. And this was just kind of like a little bit less than. But man, Ice Cream Man is still just such a creative a force for sure.
Yeah, I think the thing is, it wasn't taking whatever it was saying about spy stuff far enough. I think it was pointing at the cyclical nature of these franchises and spying in general, but it didn't quite get there. And particularly coming after two issues where they had a car crash drawn out over two issues in the most upsetting, heartbreaking way possible. I guess it's nice to have a palate cleanser, but I don't know. We come to this place.
This is more of a sorbet than an ice cream. You know what I mean?
To misquote Nicole Kidman from the AMC play, ads, we come to this place for trauma. Bring it on the next issue, please.
Oh, my God.
Jim Henson's Labyrinth, number one, from Boom Studios, written by Kyla Vanderklut, art by Giorgio Spalletta. I was really looking forward to this because I'm a huge fan of Labyrinth, but also because Labyrinth, this isn't supposed to be an adaptation of Labyrinth, the movie. This is an adaptation of the novelization of Labyrinth. So what I was very excited about, full disclosure, I have not read the novelization. Now I really want to, but I was like, ooh, what are the new things going to be? Mm-hmm. And the answer in this issue is none. no new things.
No, it's
this
all
is
the same.
Just the movie straight up, almost frame but, per frame. But yes, but I love Labyrinth, so I was delighted anyway.
There you go. There you go. And I don't want to yuck your yum, so I'm just going to say beautiful art.
No, yuck my yum. I want to hear. Go ahead. You literally, there is no way you can upset me about Labyrinth.
Okay, well, I'm not trying to upset you. I just...
Nah, that's cool. Nothing will ever make me like it less.
Okay, great. I just, I don't like the premise. I forget that I don't like the premise. And then when the girl starts saying horrible things about her brother... I can't, I'm just like.
What if she was just nice?
Yeah, exactly. What if she just was nice?
Weird recurring theme, Pete. Yeah.
No, I just, you know, I think there is like, because there's this also thing about like when you're a kid, you believe in ghosts, you believe in monsters, you like, you know what I mean? So this Goblin King thing, you know. I feel like there is this, like, you shouldn't do it because this is the time, you know, if it was a older person kind of being like, oh, this is, you know, but like, yeah, I just, it immediately turns me off and I forget about that because I think, oh my God, Jim Henson, this is Alex's favorite, you know, this is going to be, you know, and then I'm just like immediately reminded like, oh, you hate this choice.
It's so funny because reading this reminded me or made me feel, oh, what a great simple fairy tale premise setup you have here, because you have a girl She wants to be a great actress like her mother, who is gone. She has a stepmother who she wants to put into the evil stepmother role. She has a brother who's not that bad, but is forcing into the hateful, terrible little child brother role. And then it turns out she ends up in this adventure where goblins are real and the Goblin King is real. Jamming it into 20 pages here really brought that into stark relief for me in a way that I don't always get when I'm watching the movie, just because, I mean, it's still very efficient in terms of its storytelling, but it's happening over the period of 10 minutes instead of these compressed pages. So it really is a storybook setup, and it really is something that, particularly if you know the story, setting it up here, it's very clear that, like, well, this could be in her imagination. She could just be playing this through because all of the things kind of show up in that way. I don't know. I like this, but I understand why you didn't.
Also, that scared the crap out of me as a kid.
Now we're getting to it. Deathlock, 50th anniversary special, number one from Marvel, written by Christopher Priest and Justina Ireland, art by Dennis Cowan and Carlo Pagulian. We are getting two stories of Deathlock, the time-traveling cyborg, one a classic one by Priest and Dennis Cowan, and then the backup story thrusts him into an interesting new situation. I don't care about Deathlock at all, to be honest with you, but I like the second story. I thought that was fun, period.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Deathlock also not my jam. I'm more of a Death's
Head.
Really? Death's Head is my jam.
Okay. You only have room in your life for one Death character.
Not really, but...
Heads or locks? Heads or locks? Make a choice.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with the second story. It was great. Fun last panel kind of reveal. And, I feel like if you like Deathlock, you should like this book because it, feels like a lot of the Deathlock books that I've read. Yeah.
And if you're ambivalent, you'll sound like us when we're talking about it. Superman number 18 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Jamal Campbell. Superman, who is powerless, and Zatanna, who is powerless, are trying to travel the dark roads to find paths that the heroes can travel that Amanda Waller can't track. Meanwhile, Superman is just grappling with his inherent hate of magic, one of his one and only weaknesses. I thought this was a great issue. There's a neat sequence towards the beginning with Neron, however you pronounce his name, the demon character from back in the day, who all he wants to do is Superman to tell a lie, and in a really neat way, he gets out of that problem. But then the rest of the issue I thought was a nicely emotional way to tie together Superman and Zatanna, two characters that I don't really think of hanging out together. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I started off, not liking this, and then it won me over. I mean, this starts off super strong by Batman yelling, "I hate magic." And then I started to read the text.
Superman?
Yeah, Superman.
You said Batman.
Oh, my God, did I?
Yeah, they're two different characters. They're both in the same universe.
I'm aware of that.
I wasn't sure if you knew.
Sorry, it's a little slip of the tongue there. I have been drinking. but starting strong with I Hate Magic, I was like, wow, Superman coming in kind of dark and angry. Okay. And then I went, I usually don't read text boxes because of all the extra words. And then I started to read it and was, it started by saying,
what?
Amanda Waller.
You
has,
don't read text boxes?
Yeah. I don't like if there's like a big check, a bunch of words kind of, like extra reading.
Do you read
like
the dialogue, Pete?
Yes, I read the dialogue.
You read the dialogue, but not the description.
It depends how long it is, bro. You know what I mean? Like,
oh my God, that's one of the craziest things you've said in the entire time we've been doing this show.
Anyways, I'm trying to get through this here. It started with Amanda Waller has
won. You're trying to get through my description boxes is what's going on. You don't want to hear them.
Yeah.
This is explaining a lot, honestly.
Yeah, so it starts off with Amanda Waller's one, and I was like, well, I'm done reading this. But by the end of it, the twist, and spoilers, but the moment where he yells, "I love magic," gets you in the feels. I mean, Lois and – oh, my God. Just
oh,
so
I missed that. I only read every other panel in the comic book because I want to be more efficient.
Smart. Yeah.
I missed that one.
Yeah. You've known this. When I talk about those, like, X-Men books where there's just all of a sudden text boxes.
No, I know. I know you don't like dialogue, like the text pages.
Yeah.
But saying you don't read description boxes at all is great. Like, what if something says, like, meanwhile? Do you read that?
Yes. If it goes on too long, and if it starts off with me
not... What is too long? What is too long for you?
All right. Let's pull up how long this was.
If I knew that, if we've discussed this before, I blocked it out because I hate it so much.
Okay. Anyways. This really won me over, which is impressive, because I started with both my arms fully crossed, and then by the end of it was just, the old Supes and Lois stuff really gets you, so it's great.
Yeah. I thought this was a great issue. I know you haven't put as high of it, but I love these Absolute Power tie-ins. We're going to talk about another one in a little bit. So, great stuff. Ultra Mega! Number 5 from Image Comics by James Herron. This title has been away for, I want to say, 3 years at this point.
So yeah, they jam it all into this issue.
Sure do.
This took up a lot of my reading time in this one ish.
So this is actually my slight problem here. The art is still very good in this issue. But
it's amazing. What do you mean? This is really great art.
It is great art. It's very reminiscent of Daniel Warren Johnson, I would throw out there, and Jorge Corona by extension. So it's in that vein. But the original idea was that there was this giant, what's it called, Ultraman-style character who called Ultramega, who was protecting the world from kaijus. The last Ultramega died, and then we cut forward to an apocalypse where kaijus have basically ruined the world. We're following the son of the last Ultramega, who desperately wants to be an Ultramega himself. And over the first 4 issues, it didn't exactly slow play that, but it really focused on him ending up in a gladiatorial arena, gave us some awesome villains. That was what was kind of going on here. This issue has so much going on in it.
So much.
I thought there were a lot of interesting ideas in here, but I missed the simplicity of the first 4 issues that gave it that emotional hook in between all the crazy world building. You get that a little bit by the end, but again, too much going on, and I could just kind of feel the, like, well, I've been gone for 3 years, here we go!
Yeah, it seemed like something happened. Like, something happened where the team was, like, working on this, and they're like, okay, yeah, we'll let you do 10 issues. Then something happened. He came back, was like, life is short. I don't know how much time I have in this comic, so I'm putting it all here at once for you. Kind of gives you a whole, trade in this. So it's dense. But the good news is you really get to the bottom of a lot, and they're able to tell the story how they want to. So, there's definitely a shift. I love the ending, man. Oh, it really got me. It was a little gloopy and tripped out, but really just absolutely well executed.
Yeah, and I will throw out there's a character with a really big head and a tiny body. Very fun.
Yeah, he must have felt very seen.
Ouch.
You're the MODOK of the show. We all know that.
Ouch! What? So mean. Oh, my God. Can't you? You know what? Maybe I feel like the character of Pete should try being nice instead.
Oh, just try being nice? Okay.
Just try being nice.
Yeah.
Ultimate X-Men number 7 from Marvel by Peach Momoko.
I got to try being nice. All right.
Yeah. In this issue, there's also a lot of stuff going on. I fully admit, love Peach Momoko's art. I'm having a hard time holding on to the story here. You seem confused, Pete.
I don't know why you're confused. Pete, go. This is like let Peach do whatever Peach needs to do, because
what's happening though? Like, what's the story? Just real quick, sum it up.
Yeah, don't even try to. I have no fucking idea.
I knew it.
Yeah, I have no clue. But the art is taking me on such a journey. I don't care, because I just wrap me in these beautiful watercolors, and I will be happy. You can do all the crazy manga, anime, whatever you want, because this is just magical art that I don't need to make sense of. I just can enjoy how
I feel like there should be a little sense, though.
I hear you, but I'm trying to be nice here. So, you know,
I mean, kind of what we're getting is a bunch of kids in a school together all have mutant powers, kind of, as far as we know. There's Armor. There's Nico Minoru. We've got Maystorm. I'm forgetting the other. We also have this cult worshiping Homo Superior and doing something with them that I'm not sure. And meanwhile, in the middle, just kind of wandering around, she's on the cover of this issue, is Psylocke. You wouldn't know it because she's not called Quanon. She's called Kanon and doesn't seem to exhibit powers as far as I can tell in this issue. But she's there too. So there's kind of these three trains running, and I don't know. I want to know what's going on because I want to like this, but I feel like I'm losing the threads while I'm reading.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I just think it's worth it for the art alone. So, you know, I just enjoy it.
All right. Guilt Frame number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Matt Kent and Margie Kravkin. Art by Matt Kent. This is about a woman, badass grandma, if you will, except she's a badass grand aunt, I guess. Mm-hmm, and her nephew head to France to try to sell some chairs or find out how much they are worth and end up embroiled in a murder mystery. They are semi-famous investigators, and they are tangling this issue with a French investigator who is also looking into the mystery. Speaking of big issues, this is like 76 pages long.
Yeah.
Full of amazing Matt Kidd art and delightful mystery stylings. If you're a fan of Agatha Christie style things, that's pretty much straight up what they're going for here. Maybe there's some, well, no, and I think in a fantastic way. Like, I think.
Right, but there's also, I was getting a little Knives Out, a little Clue.
Knives Out is also very Agatha Christie. Yeah. Clue is very Agatha Christie, but parody. So, yes.
Also, I really love the map that we got.
Great map. Really,
oh, just, I love a good
great
map.
Pages throughout. This is just less trippy than Matt Kidd's usual work, and I keep expecting some sort of twist to happen here where it's like, and this was inside your mind. You were the chairs the whole time.
You were the chairs.
Yes, but it's not that. It's just a mystery, and it's a great one. So, good times.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman number 13 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Tony S. Daniel and Kari Randolph. The front story is an absolute power tie-in as Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor are reunited and they can't stop kissing, and Damian Wayne hates it. And then in the backup story, Damian is telling the story of the past couple of issues of Wonder Woman from his perspective to Trinity to explain how she came to be born. This is maybe the funniest issue of the week. Like, the opposite of Jenny Sparks. Even the front story is so funny and so much fun. There's badass Wonder Woman moments. Like, she doesn't have powers, and she's still trying to stop bullets.
Oh, my God, dude.
With her wrist armor. But the whole running thread of her and Steve being like, mwah, mwah,
was
so funny. It was so good.
It's just so great because Robin's like, yo, fucking knock it off. We're trying to save the world. There's no time for this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this issue.
It was so great. It really was. It was just so nice. And it kept getting better, and it was fun to just kind of see this. And, I'm so happy that, you know, what's funny is if I wasn't doing the show, I wouldn't have kept reading the Absolute Power stuff. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I'm making it past the turn is very enjoyable.
Okay.
I wouldn't have picked this up otherwise. So yeah, this is just such a great issue of comics.
Yeah, and I'll also throw out there the art. Tony S. Daniel, known for his comedy stylings, but I think really nailing the pacing of the reaction shots here and everything. And Kari Randolph, just great. You know, all the backup story, the perspective he brings to the previous issues is very fun. I missed having Belén Ortega on the backup, but Kari Randolph, real good. So there you go. X-Factor number 2 for Marvel, written by Mark Russell, art by Bob Quinn. This is the corporate X-Men team. And while Angel has been absolutely battered to crap in the last issue, Havoc is now stepping up to be the leader here, kind of against his will. Polaris, meanwhile, is in a mutant underground that is trying to advocate for mutant rights, and Havoc infiltrates them, leading to a conflict between the two. Surprisingly less satirical than the last issue, though still some very fun moments in here. There's a great riff where their corporate handler, who is a complete douchebag, is on a power dog diet, which is...
Oh my God, that was so funny.
What is it?
It's trying to eat corn dogs, like 10 corn dogs a day. Oh my God.
Just a fantastic Mark Russell bit.
Puts the corn dog in his pocket.
Do you mind if I power dog right now?
My God.
Made me laugh.
Yeah, that was enjoyable. Yeah, this is a very interesting story. This is hard for me because the relationship at the center here, Havoc and Polaris, is not one that I'm pulling for. So I don't like them together. So it's, it kind of makes it not as like, I'm not sure what I want to happen. Whereas if you like the couple, you know, this makes the tension that much more. Since I don't, you know, I really don't care what goes on. But this is still an interesting story here and amazing art. And I'm excited to see what happens next.
Yeah, I really like this team. This was not quite as strong as the first issue to me, despite the power dog joke, which was great.
Very enjoyable.
Also, really like whatever is going on with that old lady mutant who is very weird.
That's
the whole team hanging out by the pool. Triggering. That scene was very fun. I don't know. It's a fun book, but I'm not quite sure what it's trying to say yet. It seemed pretty clear for the first issue, not quite as clear for the second issue, but I'll read anything Mark Russell writes. So there you go. The Power Fantasy number 2 from Image Comics, written by Kieran Gillen, art by Casper Wingard. In the first issue, we were introduced to a world where 6 people have superpowers and they can never meet or war will start. It's basically a metaphor for the atomic age. Not basically, it 100% is, down to their children and descendants being called atomics. We're dealing with the almost quite literal fallout from the first issue here as we get a better understanding of one of our other superpowers. This is phenomenal. Kieran Gillen in the back matter talks a little bit about how Wicked and Divine came out of Young Avengers and all the things he couldn't do there. I know you didn't read this, Pete, because it was text in the back, but it's a really, really great essay by Kieran Gillen about the book. Here he's talking about how Power Fantasy came out of all the things that you can't do on X-Men. And he doesn't say it dismissively, but he said while he was writing Immortal X-Men, there's limitations of how far you can go with things when you're writing for corporate comics for the big two. And he started thinking about the Power Fantasy as a way of pushing that. And I think that really does come through here on this issue in particular. Just great mysteries. And Casper Wingard, man, his art is good.
Yeah.
All of the characters are really intriguing. Action sequences are very dynamic. There's a lot of stuff going on here. I'm really, really into the series.
Yeah, this really reminded me of Die in such a great way because of the amazing world building. Karen Gillan does such a great job of like setting up these elaborate worlds with such detail, and the art and the design of it is just so impressive and really
the thing
pulls you in
that
so
I will
quickly.
Say, just to jump off of that, and I liked all of these things to be clear, but I hope it's a little more Wicked and Divine where it has a clear, concrete story arc than Die, which felt like it came out so strong and then was like a role-playing game campaign where it's like, and then we're kind of wandering around for a while. So we'll see. This seems like it's very clear where we're going with all of this, but we'll see what happens. Either way, I'm 100% on board to the bitter end. Let's move on to another one, The Masked Mocker, number 1, from Dark Horse Comics, written by David A. Goodman, art by Alex Andres. I want to give a spoiler warning here because I do want to talk about the end of the book, but this is about an actor in the 1930s who accidentally ends up being a wrestler called The Masked Mocker, per the title. That's most of the book. There's a couple of other characters that we get to meet, including a woman who is pretending to be a man, who is a wrestler, and some others. Here's the thing, Pete. I want to throw out there, is the last page of the book, we find out he, on his second fight, has to fight a bear, and that's fun, but it's a real bear, and the bear is the one who has been narrating this issue the entire time.
I love the bear.
I also love the bear.
Not the bear of the TV show. I'm talking about the bear in this comic.
Sure. The bear of the TV show would be better with the talking bear. I'm going to throw that out there.
I would agree. Yeah. Maybe add some comedy to it, because the bear wearing glasses in this, and spoilers, but just gets me every time. That's just so funny. I love a bear just sitting in a chair with some glasses on, talking it up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. This is what I was going to say about it. This book is about a talking bear. It's not about a guy in the 1930s who accidentally becomes a wrestler. That is great. That needs to not be the last page of the book, is my point. That needs to be, like, not a secret that you hold on to.
Or I thought it was a fun reveal of, like, yes, this comic just got so much better because I've seen all these other things before. You know what I mean? The heartbreaking thing of this amazing couple who, you know, she needs to pretend to be a dude just so she can wrestle. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the struggles are real, and there's a lot of great comics to them, and that could be fun by itself. But then this fun bear twist, I was just like, wow. Yeah.
Well, that's
like,
what I'm saying is that comics, I mean, this is kind of true of everything, but just to, like, make a broad statement that's easily disproven, comics, unlike movies or TV shows or novels, have a really small amount of real estate. You got 20 pages on the first issue to sell a reader on the book. And this, again, this isn't true across the board, but if your book is about a talking bear who wrestles, that needs to be, like, if not the first page, in the first half of your book, because that's the interesting thing about the book, exactly like you're saying, Pete. Like, character dynamics are important. Setting up characters are fine. Emotional arcs are important as well. But you can introduce, hello, I'm a talking bear, and I'm going to tell you the story of the Masked Mocker on the first page. And then I am immediately enraptured by this book and far more intrigued, and then roll out all of the other relationships in this context. Not to rewrite this book, but I feel like this is just like a blanket statement. We talk about this all the time with Image comics in particular, where it's like 19 pages of, I'm a woman who really can't connect with my son. And then on page 20, it's alien invasion. And you're like, okay, but maybe if the alien invasion is on page 2, and then we find out about how the woman can't connect with her son while aliens are invading and attacking, that's more interesting than something that I could see if I walked down the block.
Yeah, but to be the other side of the coin a little bit, you think you have this story about, like, oh man, will these people be able to get it together, live out their dream of wrestling and really do the things they want to do? Oh my God, there's a bear. Oh, this all just became so much more fun. I don't know. It worked for me. I was pleasantly surprised and got very excited at the end of the comic, and then wanted more and more, looking forward to the next issue.
Well, they got you. So yeah. There you go. Avengers 18 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Valerio Schiti. Hyperion is flying towards Earth as fast as a bullet. He's going to break it because he's bummed out about the planet not remembering him and all the great deeds he did. And the Avengers are rallying to stop him along with Storm. What'd you think about this one, Pete?
Well, this was fun for a lot of different reasons, but let's just talk about something. When you hear Hyperion,
they should have introduced the talking bear on the first page.
Should have always do that.
Absolutely.
When you hear, like, Hyperion, what is the first thought that goes into your mind?
the character Hyperion. I'm not sure what you're going
to do. You get excited? Are you? Because I'm like, oh, fuck, Hyperion, really? Are we doing this? Because I don't know. Like, this book was a real emotional roller coaster because I was like, yay, Hyperion, yay. But then you get to see Scott shut down by Storm, which was just this amazing thing where Scott is like, hey, Storm, man, could really use you back on the X-Men. She's like, nah, I'm good, bro. Like, amazing moment. I was losing my shit. Really love that.
It was a really great punch, just to add on what you're saying, where I don't remember the phrase, but he says something to her and then she's like, yeah, no, I'm good. I don't think we need two leaders here. And he's like,
well, okay. She was like, we couldn't go back to co-leading or whatever. Like, I can't take orders from you again. Like, it was.
And he was like, got it. And then she's like, because of this reason. And he's like, I got it.
She's like, well, if you did, I probably wouldn't still be talking. But yeah. Oh my God. But yeah, then you got like a lot of cameos and a lot of different stuff. And then Mephisto, I was like, we're getting Hyperion and Mephisto. Like, what are we doing? But the Thor and Storm moment, oh, worth it for the price of admission right here. So cool. And then, you know, spoilers, but man, the Storm as an Avenger, like, that was just such a badass. I was like, this is too, like, I cannot wait for more of this.
Yeah. I need to see the Avengers do a little bit more avenging. I didn't love the idea that most of them were standing around their living city trying to figure out things on computers most of the time. I also didn't love, which is kind of the point of the book, that the rest of them are like, well, gotta kill Hyperion. And every single one of them except Vision was like, nope, no other choices. Sorry.
Yeah, that was where we're like, Vision. Yeah, I was like, yeah, Vision talks some sense into them. Like,
Vision being like, well, don't we have any other options? Like, no, murder is literally the only option on the table.
Yeah.
That really icked me out.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
Falling in Love on the Path to Hell, number 4 from Image Comics, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Gary Brown. We are following a cowboy and samurai, Ronin?
Yeah, man, kind of.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, they are on a purgatory island being forced to fight, except they're falling in love on the path to hell, and they may have found a way out. This is very much a slow burn, but Pete, you are the slow burn master here, so what's going on?
Yeah, shout out to the Dougs. I think that the, you know, we didn't get any of the love at all, except for in this issue. So this was, I mean, I love a rom-com, and I love a great kiss. And man, this was a great kiss. I just thought it was just very well done. Just so smart and the revealing of the kind of characters and them seeing them stuff and have something to talk about. I just love the way he was like, hey, what the F? And she was just like, what? We didn't have anything to say. I had nothing to say to you.
You're talking about her reveal that she knows English.
No, the fact that she was like, I had nothing to say to you, didn't want to say to you. And then I saw something, you do something.
Oh, okay.
Just absolutely fantastic. And that can change my whole opinion of you. And I was just like, oh, I love that. I just thought it was so well done and well executed and such a great, powerful kiss. So, this was too much of a slow burn at some points for me. But now I'm kind of like, yeah, let's go. This was
fire burning.
This was great. Yeah, this was great.
Nice. Lawful, number 4 from Boom Studios, written by Greg Pak, art by Diego Galindo. This takes place in a city where if you break the law in any small or big way, it shows up on you physically. Our main character has been growing a red scale dragon chest as he's been doing very lightly wrong things. But it leads in this issue to him and his mom getting kicked out of the city. And surprise, surprise, things are not quite so bad outside as they thought. This was my favorite issue of the series so far. I've really enjoyed it up to here and has been wasting no time getting through the story. But man, this one was such an emotional punch. driving home the relationship between Sung, I believe is the name of the main character, and his mom, both through the past and the present. There are some beautiful pages in here by Diego Galindo. There's one where they're in this encampment, village, whatever you want to call it, right outside the city, and they draw Sung and his mother embracing with other people sitting around. You see this village, you see the city in the distance, the sun glinting. Really, really stunning work. This is great.
Yeah, another banger ish of this. I just think that, you know, we got a little bit of a last page reveal at the end that got me scared. But man, I am having such a blast with this. The world that Pak is creating here is unbelievable. And I have a feeling this Greg Pak guy is going to be pretty good writer. Everything really clicked in this issue. And really started to kind of go on all cylinders for me. So it's just super impressive with the way this story is coming together and the momentum that's being built here. This is really awesome. Jump on in. Get on board with this because this is going to be a great ride.
Should you jump on in or should you get on board? Which one should you do?
Either way, whichever you're more comfortable with, but pick up this fucking comic.
There you go. X-Men number 4 from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Netho Diaz. In this issue, the team, or at least part of the team, is going off to fight Trevor Fitzroy, who has put together a team of mutant killers and hunters for a big reveal villain towards the end of this issue that is a great villain that I had completely forgotten about. I haven't been loving this title as much as some of the other From the Ashes era stuff, but I am a total sucker for Trevor Fitzroy. He's such a jerk villain that it's kind of great and terrible to see it back here. And again, the person he's working for is a great reveal as well.
Okay, well, let's not spoil it because you say great, and I was like, what? But anyways, amazing art. This feels like a classic kind of X-Men story in a good way. You know, this is a little tough for me. I still haven't forgiven Beast yet, so it's kind of hard. But, you know, Scott is kind of a douche in this, so that's enjoyable. But, I mean, the guy doesn't even go on missions anymore, so boom. Mm-hmm.
I will say a lot of these books are doing a very good job of convincing me that Cyclops sucks. Like, that seems to be the main push of
all the X-Men. I've been saying it for years.
Well, all the X-Men titles recently add Avengers, as we just talked about, are like, you know who sucks? Cyclops. Also in the X-Men book where he's a leader, Cyclops sucks. And it's just very funny.
It's very bandwagon. It's like everybody's getting on board. And then I'm kind of like, hey, maybe, you know, like it just feels
weird. Every single book, too. Rogue gives him a phone call and Cyclops is like, you get back here right now, Rogue, and you bring your team. And she's like, shut up. And then I don't remember who called him. I think like not Kitty called him, but somebody else called him over an exceptional election and same thing. They're like, leave me alone. It's a funny running bit, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Babs, number 2 Babs. From Ahoy Comics, written by Garth Ennis, art by Jason Burroughs. This is a fantasy parody. Our main character, Babs, is a Red Sonja type. But the main thrust of this book is not just playing on fantasy tropes, but also playing on modern cultural tropes. We're following a goblin and trolls and a bunch of other folks who are basically not men's rights activists, but the sort of people that are like, God, in the first issue, they were upset that they keep changing the gender of the warriors that they're following. You get what they're going for. In the end of the last issue, a bunch of white knights came into town and they were like, oh man, this is going to save us. And suddenly they start to realize over the course of this issue that even though they have aligned themselves with these white knights, the white knights maybe don't want people who are different hanging around with them. So again, it's very pointed cultural commentary going on here that I think is very smartly and sharply done. And then meanwhile, Babs is dealing with a skeleton army who accidentally walks in on our bathing.
Oh my God, that was hysterical.
So funny.
That was so funny. And also the argument that the skeletons get into.
Yeah.
So funny. Oh my God. It seems like Garth Ennis is having a blast with this. It's fun to see Garth Ennis having fun. I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on here, but it just seems like they're having a great time, and it really comes through in the panels and the pages.
Yeah, and we talked about this with the first issue as well, I believe, but somebody responded to something we had put up at Babs. I legitimately don't remember what platform it was, but they were going into the classic, like, calling this woke, go broke with this thing. First of all, it's probably doing extremely well for Ahoy Comics. Second of all, shut up. Third of all, this comic book is about you. So there you go.
Oh, wow, dude. You're really
the Graveyard Club. Those people can go to hell.
Whatever.
They can fall off the path to hell, is what I would say.
All I'm saying is so what happens is one of the characters is, you know, taking a bath in the river like you do in these olden times kind of thing, you know?
Sure.
And a skeleton's
or
like...
Or these modern times, if you want.
Yeah. Still available. Yeah, it's a good point. That's a good point.
As long as it's private.
And the skeleton's like, oh my God, I am so sorry. And the other skeleton's like, Gary, like we talked about this. Oh, it's just so funny. And Gary's like, no, I didn't mean to. I wouldn't, you know, the other skeleton's like, loud coughing, making your entrance known so you can't sneak up. Oh, it's just so funny and good. And oh, yeah, it was just very enjoyable.
Also, another great bit, and then we can move on. The sword, who's constantly like ripping into Babs and calling her a loser, also a very funny bit. Just great stuff. And not enough could be said about Jason Burroughs' art, who is the perfect match for this. Great stuff. The Graveyard Club, number one for Boob Studios, written by R.L. Stein, art by Corolla Borelli. We are following a bunch of teens who hang out in a graveyard per the title. And then some spooky things are going on in the town. Ooh.
Yeah. There's a lot going on.
Sure is.
And, but I love the art, and where it ends, I'm looking forward to what's happening next. But I mean, you got jealous exes here. You got crappy cops. You've got bullies. You've got bats that seem to know people. And a lot of graves that for some reason nobody cares about. And then casually being like, hey, you know when your dad died? Yeah, my dad died on the same day. Weird we never talked about that, right? You know, I'm just like, wow.
There's a lot of stuff in there. I know R.L. Stein is a classic, but there's things like there's a scene where two people are making out and they're like, whoa, where'd my gum go? And they're like, uh-oh, I think I swallowed it. And it's like, does anybody ever really do that outside of movies or TV shows or anything like that? Pete, do you ever eat gum out of another person's mouth?
But it was also like, it was funny because it was also like, where's my gum? And the other person's like, I swallowed it.
Only did you take the gum out of another person's mouth, but then you swallowed that gum?
Why would you?
I don't know. And that was the minor thing, but then I started off at that moment. I was like, huh? What? And then the entire book went from there, and it's... spoiler here, it's just humans as far as I can tell in this book, but every couple of pages would be something like, oh, here we go, there's zombies coming. No, that's another human. Oh, no. There's bats. Okay, it's a vampire. No, it's just bats. All right. Okay, here we go. So I don't know. R.L. Stein never really been my thing, to be honest with you. Very nice guy.
But there's also this weird moment where, like, you know, sometimes in movies or things where there's a budget and stuff where you're like, oh, they couldn't do that, right? But there's this moment where it's like this bat flies into the room and the character goes, that's weird. That bat seems like it knows you. And I was like, what about a bat flying into your room would make you say something? Like, they could have paused and shown a bat giving a look. Like, it's not like there's you know, you can only have so many panels, but I was like, that's such a weird thing to say because you didn't show it. You said it. And I can't get that out of my head of how does the bat fly like it knows you? Yeah. Like,
it would have to fly into your room and be like, Pete.
It would have to like look you up and down and be like, my man, for me to say something like, how does that bat know you? Because what happened was a bat flew in and then flew away. And they're like, somebody says something
weird.
Maybe it's
weird. Like, know you emotionally, like you made, you know, like an emotional connection with the bat.
Yeah, immediately, within a second.
Yeah, know. I don't know. I don't know what was going on in this book. Good Corolla Borelli art. I think the characters look good.
Yeah.
there you go. Last but not least, or maybe least, I don't know, Witchblade number three from, I don't know, we'll find out from the review, and I want to spoil it, from Witchblade number three from Top Cow Image Comics, written by Marguerite Bennett, art by Giuseppe Caffaro. In this issue, Sarah Pazzini continues to be dealing with her Witchblade, leading up to a big cliffhanger at the end. Dot, dot, dot. What'd you think, Pete?
I didn't like your setup because I think this is Witchblade done really well. I love the choices with this, where Witchblade is a cool character and isn't always just this walking like, I'm naked, but I'm not. I'm Witchblade. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad we're like not doing that. We're going to kind of lean into the character because it is a very interesting and cool character that can do a lot. So I'm glad that we're kind of getting this side of this character and I don't have to feel weird about reading this.
Yes, I agree with you on that. I think I like the first two issues a little better.
How dare you?
No, I still like this. Okay. The art is very good. I agree with you. This Sarah Pazzini is interesting. This is absolutely Witchblade done right. I think that's a good way of putting it. It follows roughly some of the plot of the past, but you can jump right in here and you don't need to know anything about the character to enjoy it. Yeah. There were more pointed, bigger scenes, I think, in the first two issues. This is very much her being like, I have this Witchblade. What do I do with this Witchblade?
Struggle of the power and what do you, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But starting with what happens at the end of this issue, I think we're going to be back to some big action next issue. So
great
stuff. And folks, that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support the show and all the shows we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Yeah, and just let us know if you want us to start each episode by more, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff where we can just kind of really get meta before we get into all the comics and stuff like that. You know
what I mean? Is that the sort of thing that would be nice? That blows your mind.